Welcome back to The Jewish Story, a Jewish history podcast for the 21st century. In this show, we'll take a look back at the history of the Jewish people, relying on historical documents, archaeologic artifacts, and linguistic data to paint a picture of the past. Last episode, we surveyed the complicated relationship between Christians and Jews in Italian society, saw the creation of the Jewish ghetto in Rome, the institution of the Roman Inquisition, and the expulsion of Jews from the Papal States. We then followed Gracia and Joseph Nassi to Constantinople and learned of their immense influence on regional politics of the time. Finally, we returned to Europe, where by the end of the 16th century, Jews were finally beginning to be readmitted, although still enduring significant racism and hatred. This week, we will look across the world and learn more about the Jews of India, China, and West Africa, communities who had been around for centuries but come into the historical record most prominently around this time. We'll begin this episode by looking at the Jews of India, who we first heard about last season when we met the three earliest Indian Jewish communities, the B'nai Israel, India's oldest Jewish community, the Cochin Jews, who descended from refugees fleeing the First Jewish-Roman War, and the Baghdadi Jews, who lived on India's eastern border with Bangladesh. But as we've moved forward in time, two new Indian Jewish communities have entered the mix. First were the Malabari Jews, who were named after their initial settlements along the Malabar coast. Just like the B'nai Israel, this community began with Jewish traders who did business in India, and who came to be viewed by the local population as their own unique merchant caste. Over the years, these Jewish traders settled in the area, met and married local Indian women, and had children. These children, although they looked just like the local Indian population, were actively practicing Jews, and were viewed as truly Jewish by the Malabari community, who had adopted the Indian custom of patrilineal succession. The Malabari Jewish community grew over time, and developed their own unique culture and traditions, blending traditional Judaism with the surrounding Indian culture. A new pidgin language, a blend between the local Malayalam language and Hebrew, became their lingua franca, and they observed all the Jewish holidays, but with unique cultural variations. For example, on Simchat Torah, they covered their synagogues with jasmine and satins, paraded Torahs through the streets in a portable ark accompanied by drums and a brass band, and at the end of the day, the ark was disassembled and its pieces were cast into the river, a ritual borrowed from Hindu ceremonies of rebirth. Most of the Malabari Jews worked as artisans, porters, and boatmen around the city of Kranganore, but after the Periyar River flooded in 1341, many had to relocate south to the city of Kochi, where the Cochin Jews had been living for centuries. The Cochin Jews traced their origins back to the 1st century, when Jewish refugees fleeing the First Jewish-Roman War had resettled around the city. By the 15th century, they had become a small but important community in India, and had developed a special relationship with the local ruler. In an 11th century scroll written in the Tamil language, the local Raja affirmed the Jews' right to settle in his realm, to practice their religion undisturbed, to build synagogues, light day lamps, and sound trumpets on their festival days. The Cochin Jews were also granted certain tax exemptions, had their own Jewish burial grounds, and the community was gifted 72 free homes by the Raja. But in the late 15th century, the peaceful lives of the Indian Jews were upset by a large wave of immigration. First were Jewish and Converso immigrants fleeing the Spanish Inquisition, joined by other Jewish migrants from Yemen, Ottoman Turkey, Palestine, and the cities of Aleppo and Baghdad. These Jews were mostly well-connected traders, and initially settled in Kranganore, where there was still a large Malabari Jewish community. Adding to this wave of Jewish immigration was the arrival of the Portuguese, who at this point were still actively sailing the world, attempting to conquer new territory. Portuguese soldiers landed on the west coast of India in 1510, bringing Christianity and the ethos of the Inquisition with them. Finding Jews in India, Admiral Alfonso de Albuquerque, one of the earliest Portuguese officials there, requested of the King of Portugal to be allowed, quote, to exterminate the Jews one by one as they are encountered, end quote. Additional pressures on the Jews came from the Muslim Indians of Cranganore, who were so unhappy with the sudden wave of migration that they launched a violent assault on Cranganore's Jews in 1523. By the year 1556, the Portuguese Inquisition had officially made its way into India, and in its first few years, over 4,000 suspected Judaizers were arrested, and 72 were burned at auto-de-fés. The Western Indian Jews, mostly Sephardic refugees from Spain and Portugal, were chased by the encroaching Portuguese colonists from Goa on the west coast, through Cranganore, and finally on to Kochi. Luckily for the Jews, the Portuguese stopped short of a full-scale invasion of the old town of Kochi, not wanting to declare open war against the Raja there. As it turns out, the Raja of Kochi happened to be a supporter of these new Jewish migrants, who came to be known as Paradesi, or foreigners. In 1568, he commissioned the building of a synagogue for the Paradesi Jews, located very close to his own palace, in an area which came to be known as Jewtown. Outside the synagogue, a clock tower was built, which to this day has one face inscribed in Hebrew for the Paradesi Jews, and one face in Judeo-Malayalam for the Malabari Jews. And so, by the mid-16th century, there were two main Jewish communities living side by side in Kochi: the Paradesi, who were lighter-skinned Sephardim, and the dark-skinned Malabari. The two communities, interestingly enough, had some animosity towards one another. They didn't intermarry, prayed at different synagogues, and had their own shochetim, and would not eat meat killed by the others. The Malabari saw the Paradesi as pretentious, and felt they had an air of cultural superiority. Both communities still exist in India to this day. Having surveyed the Jews of India, let's next move on to meet the Jews of China. Although the history of Jews in China may date back as far as the 1st century CE during the Han Dynasty, it was not until the 13th through the 16th centuries that the earliest and most abundant of the historical documentation about Chinese Jewry were produced. Perhaps the earliest evidence of Jews in China comes from an 8th century Hebrew slicha that was recently discovered in a cache of medieval documents in Dunhuang, China. Brief mentions of Jews in China were made by Marco Polo in The Book of the Marvels of the World, his 1286 memoir depicting his travels through the Far East, as well as by several Arab geographers who traveled through China in the 13th and 14th centuries. There are also Chinese tax ordinances from the 13th century that mention Jews. But the bulk of our information about the Jews of China comes from four stone tablets inscribed with Chinese writing, dated from the 15th to the 17th centuries, that were found in the synagogue in the city of Kaifeng. It is these, together with the writings of a Jesuit missionary, Matteo Ricci, that reveal much of the history and cultural practice of the Jews of China. In the aforementioned sources, there are conflicting reports as to when Jews first settled in China, and where exactly they came from. However, based on 13th century Arab writings, which describe the Chinese Jews as speaking both Mandarin and Judeo-Persian, we can surmise that the early Chinese Jews immigrated from Persia along the Silk Road, likely sometime in the 10th century CE. This date is corroborated by the oldest of the stone inscriptions in Kaifeng, dated to 1489, which explains that the Jews of China came from Tianzhu, a term meaning a place far to the west, during the Song Dynasty in the 10th century. According to the inscription, the 70 families to first arrive in China appeared before the emperor and presented him with fine, multicolored cloth made of cotton, a fabric that was almost exclusively made in India at that time. The emperor, pleased with this show of respect from the Jews, gave them his blessing. He said, quote, "Come to our China, honor and preserve the customs of your ancestors, stay here and hand them down through the generations," unquote. Although it is difficult to determine the veracity of this story's details, what it tells us is that Jews have been in China since at least the 10th century, and enjoyed relative freedom there under the Song Dynasty. They could live wherever they wanted and own their own land, lived side by side with non-Jews, and even married Chinese women, some of whom converted to Judaism. They were not given any trouble by the Chinese government, and could enter any field of work they chose, many being farmers, merchants, soldiers, doctors, and scholars. The Jews of China did have some unique traditions, however. Many were polygamous and kept concubines, which was not uncommon at the time in China. And, just like in India, Jewish descent in China was patrilineal, in contrast to the Judaism of Europe. By the 16th century, there were several Jewish communities in China, primarily scattered throughout the Zhejiang province along the east coast. But the community from which we have learned the most about Chinese Jewish religious practice and belief is the Jewish community of Kaifeng, located just inland from the Yellow Sea, in China's Henan province. The Jewish population of Kaifeng at the turn of the 17th century was about 2,000 people, approximately the same as in modern-day Halifax. These Jews called their religion Yiselye, the Chinese word for Israel, and built their first synagogue in 1163, where they would gather to pray and read Torah. The temple looked very much like Buddhist and Confucian temples of the time, with the classic resting hill roof of traditional Chinese buildings. Inside, it had a chair of Moses, from which the Torah was read, and from which the rabbi would give his formal judgments. Although this tradition does not survive in Jewish Europe and North America, it seems to have been an ancient Jewish tradition, and can be found in some of the earliest synagogues in the world, including the famous Dura Europos Synagogue, which we discussed in Season 1. The Kaifeng Temple also had an Aron Kodesh, where they kept their sheepskin Torah, which they read in a cycle of 54 parshot, or chapters, similar to the custom of the ancient Persian Jews. The Kaifeng Jews had their own sort of kehillah structure as well, with a rabbi and a second spiritual leader called a manla, and kept many Jewish traditions. They kept kashrut, including having their own experts in ritual slaughter. Based on these strange dietary laws, the local Chinese sometimes referred to the community as Tiao Jinjiao, or the sect which plucks the sinew. The Kaifeng Jews performed the ritual of circumcision, wor kippot during prayer, and would bathe in the mikveh, or ritual bath, for purification. They celebrated Jewish holidays on the correct dates of the Hebrew calendar, including Yom Kippur, as is described in the 1663 stone inscription, quote, "At the end of autumn, the Jews close their doors for a whole day and give themselves up to the cultivation of purity, cutting themselves off entirely from food and drink in order to nourish the higher nature. On that day, the scholar interrupts his reading and the farmer suspends his work of plowing or reaping, and the traveler stops on his way. Desires are forgotten, attainments set aside, and all apply themselves to preserving the heart and nourishment of the mind, so that through direction there may be a restoration of goodness." Unquote. And the Jews of Kaifeng did not worship idols, a practice that was common in China at the time. Just as was the case in India, what made Chinese Jewry particularly unique was the way they attempted to reconcile their Judaism with the surrounding culture. From the 10th century onward, during the 300 years of the Song Dynasty, and built upon during the subsequent Yuan and Ming dynasties, Neo-Confucianism had become the dominant religion and philosophy around which Chinese society was based. Neo-Confucianism, a blend of original Confucian principles with ideas borrowed from Taoism, centered on the idea of nature and society as being a hierarchy, which was to be respected. Ancestors were to be venerated, superiors were to be treasured, and everyone was to know their place. Neo-Confucianism also borrowed the Taoist idea of qi, the great life force or energy that was encompassed within and connecting all things, and acknowledged the ancient Chinese idea of Tianming, the way of heaven, essentially a sort of divine power bestowed upon the emperor that was predicated on good moral behavior. The Jews attempted to square their Jewish beliefs and practices with the surrounding Neo-Confucian culture, with a clear aim of positioning themselves as friends of the empire. The first inscription describes Abraham, the first Jew, as a descendant of Pangu Adam, a character who was a blend of Adam, the first human created by God, outlined in the book of Genesis, and Pangu, a Chinese mythological figure who was thought to be the first living being brought into existence in the cosmos. The inscription also lists Judaism's similarities with Neo-Confucianism, saying that it is, quote, "nothing more than honoring the way of heaven, venerating ancestors, giving high regard to the relations between the prince and his ministers, being respectful to parents, living in harmony with wife and children, preserving the distinction between superiors and inferiors, and having neighborly relations with friends, unquote. The subsequent three inscriptions continue to emphasize the similarities between Jewish and Neo-Confucian philosophy. Moses, the famous Jewish sage, was called Shifu, master of the laws and father of the correct way. This way that the Chinese Jews had of understanding their unique place in Chinese society was also a means of adapting to certain strong elements of Chinese tradition, which were more or less mandatory for the Jews if they were to be tolerated and accepted. One of these was the practice of ancestor worship by burning incense, a key Confucian ideal. Worship of anything besides God is technically forbidden in Judaism, of course, but the Chinese Jews likened this to the Jewish practice of lighting an annual Yahrzeit memorial candle on the anniversary of ancestors' deaths, and so decided it was acceptable. Similarly, the monotheism of Judaism kind of jived with the Neo-Confucian idea of qi, the great creative life force connecting all things. It was also customary in Chinese temples to hang a tablet with the emperor's name on it, before which people could bow and pray. In order to make this not idolatrous, the Kaifeng Jews inscribed the Shema prayer in gold on top of the tablet, so that when Jews bowed before it, it was to God, not the emperor. But the result of all this assimilation, plus the geographic and social isolation of the Jews of China from the rest of the diaspora, was that Jewish tradition began to fade, and the Jews began to meld more and more with the Chinese Muslim communities, who shared many of their core beliefs and traditions. Chinese Jews began to worship in mosques alongside Muslims, and they slowly lost the ability to accurately copy and read Torah scrolls in Hebrew. This was the state of affairs when, in 1605, Matteo Ricci, leader of the first successful Jesuit mission to China, was paid a visit by a stranger. His visitor was a 60-year-old man in a long silk coat and blue Chinese-style cap, whose name was Ai Tian. Ai Tian was a Jew from Kaifeng, and had made his way to Beijing because he had heard rumors about a group of monotheists who had traveled to China. Now, although this group was in fact the Catholic Jesuits, Ai Tian, having been disconnected from the wider world for centuries and having never heard of Christianity, was convinced that these must be Jews visiting China, with whom he could reconnect. As it turns out, Ricci, the leader of the mission, was under the exact opposite assumption. As Ai Tian described his monotheistic beliefs, Ricci thought he must be a member of a lost sect of early Christianity. It was not until Ai Tian misinterpreted some of Ricci's Christian artwork as Jewish, for example, thinking the Virgin Mary and baby Jesus was actually a painting of Rebecca and Jacob, that the two realized their misunderstanding. But the fact that Ai Tian was a Jew was not a total loss for Ricci and his Jesuit mission. Ricci presumed that, given that the Kaifeng Jews were already monotheistic, they would be all the easier to convert to Christianity. So he cultivated a relationship with Ai Tian, and the following year, Ai Tian returned to Beijing with more information for Ricci about the Kaifeng Jewish community. In 1607, Ricci sent two Chinese Christian converts to Kaifeng with a letter for the community's rabbi, telling him that he had in Beijing copies of all of the sacred Jewish texts, as well as copies of the New Testament, which he secretly hoped the Jews would prefer. The rabbi wrote back, asking Ricci if he would consider becoming the new rabbi of the Kaifeng synagogue. This is another demonstration of how disconnected the Kaifeng Jews were with the rest of the world, particularly with the whole idea of Christianity. In 1610, Ricci hosted a delegation of Kaifeng Jews at his mission in Beijing, where he treated them to a kosher banquet and again attempted to convert them. Not long after, Ricci died, never having successfully converted the Kaifeng Jews. The remainder of the story of the Kaifeng Jews is one both of tragedy and perseverance. In the late 1630s, a rebel group called the Manchus began a coup in an attempt to overthrow the Ming dynasty and take rule of China. Their coup was a success, and they swept their way southwest across China, conquering as they went. In 1642, Kaifeng was besieged by a Manchu army, leading to such devastation and starvation in the city that people were selling the flesh of the dead to be eaten. In an attempt to break the siege, the Ming governor of Kaifeng directed the dikes in the Yellow River to be destroyed, creating a catastrophic flood that killed 300,000 people and flooded the city entirely, but was successful in wiping out the Manchu army and ending the siege. In the aftermath of the flood, a Jewish major named Zhao took to repairing the roads near the Kaifeng synagogue and posted soldiers to patrol the synagogue in order to protect it. Two young Jewish scholars scoured the city to find the Torah, which had been washed away, and the 26 sacred Jewish texts that had been housed in the temple's library. They were ultimately successful in finding fragments of the Torah and 10 of the 26 books, some of which still survive, water damage and all. The temple was rebuilt on its original site, and a stone tablet was inscribed with the story of the siege and rebuilding of the temple, created in 1663 and placed on the wall of the south side of the synagogue. This tablet has been lost to history, unfortunately, but an ink rubbing of it still exists, so we can read it in its entirety. Here it might be wise to leave a brief note about the modern fate of the Chinese Jews. The Chinese government in recent days has been cracking down on Chinese Jewry, attempting to unite politically and religiously the Chinese population. As a result, many of the Chinese Jewish relics of the time have been confiscated, and Chinese Jewish synagogues have been forced to be shut down. We will speak more about this as we get into more of the modern history of the Jews. Having met the Jews of India and China, let's now close out Season 4 with a look at the Jews of Africa. The last we heard about African Jewry was way back in Season 2, where we explored the legends around their origins. It is important to mention here that there's a whole lot of information out there about African Jews, but much of it, produced in the 16th to 20th centuries, was heavily biased or influenced by colonial interests. In this historical context, the adoption of a Jewish identity by Africans served either to reinforce their inferiority in the eyes of Christian colonists, or sometimes represented the ideological kinship between the Jews in the Bible and the Africans, both of whom experienced slavery and subjugation, and thus was a means for Africans to reclaim an identity separate and elevated from the one imposed on them by their colonial masters. There are only two primary Jewish communities in Africa that, historically, have some legitimate basis for claiming direct Jewish ancestry: the Beta Israel of Ethiopia and the Lemba of South Africa. This review is not meant to take away from or delegitimize the self-identification of any group as being Jewish, but rather is an attempt, as I always do in this podcast, to describe the most historically accurate view that I can. Let us talk about the Lemba first. For centuries, the Lemba tribe of South Africa has claimed some Jewish heritage and ancestry. They follow several Jewish traditions, including the blowing of the shofar, keeping a form of kashrut, and circumcising their boys, though they do it between 7 and 15 years old, more similar to the Muslim tradition. According to their own oral tradition, they are descendants of the tribe of Levi, who emigrated from Israel thousands of years ago, passing through the city of Sena in Yemen before sailing across the Indian Ocean down to southern Africa. Their tradition also has it that they were responsible for building the ancient stone city of Great Zimbabwe in southern Africa, which is now a well-studied archaeological site that has been dated to around the 14th century CE. Recent DNA evidence shows that there is a high frequency of certain genetic markers in the Lemba that are seen much more frequently in Jews than in the general population. These genetic markers are even more prominent in the priestly Buba clan, in which they are present with the same frequency as in Jewish Kohanim. This leaves very intriguing evidence that the Lemba people very well may have some direct Jewish ancestry. It is worth mentioning the Beta Israel of Ethiopia here briefly. Ethiopia had been predominantly Christian since the 5th century CE, and there had been few and brief Christian missionaries there before the 19th century. There was also already a national story that all Ethiopians descended from the dynasty of Menelik, son of the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon. The Beta Israel, who saw themselves as a unique population, and who originally invited upon themselves the designation of Israelites, though actually originally did not identify with the label Jew, Yehuda in their native Ge'ez language. The Beta Israel also historically had no knowledge of Hebrew, and there is no evidence that they had Hebrew texts prior to the 19th century. DNA evidence published by Doron Behar in Nature, the most preeminent scientific journal in the world, shows that genetically, the Beta Israel are far more similar to the surrounding Ethiopian clans than they are to Jews or Levantine peoples. Together, this suggests that although the Beta Israel have a strong Jewish identity, their unique Jewish culture likely evolved as a spin-off of Christianity, and their community evolved culturally as opposed to bringing ancient Judaism directly from Israel. Still more is known about West African Jews, particularly in the early 17th century. At the turn of the 17th century, the Kingdom of Spain had established colonies and trading posts on the islands of Cape Verde and São Tomé, but they had yet to conquer the West African mainland, as there were powerful African monarchies there with formidable armies who would be tough to beat. But Spain still wanted to get a foothold there, if not with actual colonies, then at least to benefit from a trading relationship. To this end, in 1601, King Philip III of Spain gave permission for Jewish merchants to settle and trade along a portion of the West African coast. And so, in the first 20 years of the 17th century, a small colony of Portuguese Jews established themselves in Senegal and established trading relationships with the Senegambian kings, with whom they would trade weapons and swords in exchange for animal hides, beeswax, and ivory, which they would send back for trade in Amsterdam, and African slaves, which they would trade on into the New World. This small Jewish community began to blend with the local African population, with some Jewish men taking African wives, converting them to Judaism, and raising families with them. Because of the local African tradition of culture being passed down through the father, the Jews there adopted the same tradition, and the children of these mixed marriages were seen by the Jewish community there as fully Jewish. This ultimately led to the formation of a small mixed-race Jewish community, descended from the Portuguese Jewish fathers and African mothers. This community building served to ally the Muslim African Wolof kings to the Jews, as is evidenced by a quote from a contemporary converso. Quote, "To this port came people who profess the law of Moses, and here they do maintain their rituals and ceremonies, like the ones of Judea, and the Portuguese seeking to kill them and expel them from that place ran a serious risk. Because the king took the side of the Jews and told the Portuguese that his land was a market where all kinds of people had a right to live, and no one could cause disorder in his lands, otherwise he would order their heads cut off." End quote. But as the years went on, hostilities began to increase between the West African kings and the Spanish-Portuguese armies, and the Senegambian Jews began to worry for their safety. This prompted a number of them to emigrate out of Africa and back to Europe, particularly into the Netherlands, where in 1609, Spain had made a truce with the Dutch that would last until 1621. And that brings us to the end of Season 4 of our Jewish story. Next season, we will pick up where we left off, with the Jews still exiled from nearly all of Western Europe and eking out a dangerous life in Christian Italy. Eastern European Jewry will rise to even greater cultural heights, and new groups of Jews and conversos will begin making their way into the New World, including, for the first time, into North America. In the Middle East, the Ottomans will continue their centuries of dominance, and the Jews of the Far East and Africa will continue their unique cultural evolution. That's all coming up on Season 5 of The Jewish Story.